This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor these brave men and women for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, we sure are educated and inspired by how much these people love our country. The guy we're going to hear from today just turned 90 years old, and we are sitting in the middle of an oil field. I can't say I've ever done this before, just north of Bakersfield, because this is where Walt Fies lives and works. You've been in the oil business since you got out of World War II, and I know they appreciate you out here at E&B. But let's talk about way back when. You were growing up a long way from Bakersfield, up in Northern California. I've never heard of Likely. Tell us where Likely, California is.
Altruz is a big town there, and 20 miles south of there is Likely. And that's where I lived on the ranch. We went to high school in Modoc Union High School in Altruz, California.
You know, I grew up in Los Banos, and people used to say, oh, you're from the bathrooms. I said, no, it's the baths. I bet when you're from Likely and you run into other kids, they say they probably had a joke or two about that hometown, huh?
Sure, they likely to do this, likely to do that, you know. All that kind of stuff.
Did you come from a big family?
I had two brothers. Myself, I was the oldest. My brother Bill in the Navy there. Yeah. And my brother Steve had a crippled hand. He didn't get in.
So what was it like growing up in Likely, California before World War II?
It was nice. Spent every fall hunting deer back out in the hills. And that's one reason I'm still here, because I learned to go through the woods silently and everything. Go get them mule-tailed deer up there, 150 pounds apiece, you know.
Yeah, little did you know that hunting mule-tailed deer was preparing you for fighting the Germans, huh?
No, I didn't know it at that time, but it did, because it learned me how to drop down behind trees and sneak in behind bushes and stuff like that.
Yeah, Walt is a paratrooper from World War II. We're going to hear about that, how that happened. But I like to ask everybody about December 7th, 1941. And I'm guessing you were probably in your final year of high school when that rolled around, huh?
Modoc Union High School, they took us into the auditorium, gathered us all in there and turned the radio on. We listened to Roosevelt make his speech, you know, and about the dastardly day and day that we'll live in infamy and all that. So we stayed in there and did that. And then I went ahead and finished high school. And in 43, I entered the paratroopers.
You didn't wait around to get drafted? You volunteered yourself?
No, they drafted me, but I volunteered for the paratroopers.
Why paratroopers? And how'd you even know what a paratrooper was?
I just knew it jumped out of airplane. I thought it would be romantic to do, so I had it in my head, and nothing would stop me from it. So I went to it and ended up in Camp Tocoa, Georgia, training for paratroops with the 517th Parachute Infantry Combat Team.
People don't realize that this is something that really hadn't happened before World War II. They know that there were paratroopers in World War II, but I don't know that people realize how pioneering this was and how unprecedented it was. Did you have any idea of what you were getting yourself into?
Well, of course, those sergeants told us all that, you know. When we got to Fort Benning, Georgia, they had all these sergeants out there, and you go 1 hour at a time to each sergeant, and they teach you everything, judo, everything. Do that for 3 weeks, and then on the fourth week, you make your jumps. And so all them sergeants had speeches, nomenclature and care of your weapons and all that kind of stuff. Then they took us out and pulled us up on them towers, you know. You might have saw that, where they pull you up on a tower 200 feet in the air and cut you loose and down you come.
Yeah, and those towers are still there at Fort Benning. I've seen the pictures, and our paratroopers today still jump off of them. Now, those towers initially came from the World's Fair, I think, right?
I think so, yeah. They're tall. Boy, they're big. Yeah.
What does that feel like of the first time that you're up there and they put you out on that arm wide of the tower and drop you from 200 feet?
You're nervous, but you've been taught and everything. You just try to do what you've been told, and you come right on down and land. What they're doing with that is to fix you so when you hit, you learn to bend your knees. It's imperative that you bend your knees when you're falling in a parachute and you roll on your shoulder.
What would you say was the most difficult aspect of your training there?
14 or 16 weeks, whatever it was, of basic training. At Camp Tocoa, Georgia, we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning and run 2.5 miles up Mount Chattahoochee, which is straight up, and run back down. And then we took a shower and ate breakfast. Sometimes we'd go forced marches with all of our packs on, go out all night long and everything. And so that was tough. But they taught us and made our bodies strong. That's what they did.
Well, I guess they had to make your body strong, and they probably had to make your mind pretty strong, because I don't know about you, but it might have occurred to me that if I'm jumping out of an airplane and landing behind enemy lines, that this is going to be some pretty dangerous duty I'm taking on.
I did it, and it is dangerous.
And as that training went on, were you getting anxious? Were you antsy to get over there and fight this war?
Well, yeah. You train so long, you get kind of anxious. We went up to Newport News, Virginia, got on that Grace Lines, Santa Maria. It was a Grace Lines from the West Coast, and they'd taken them all back there. And we was on the Santa Maria, and they took us over and took us through the Straits of Gibraltar and into Naples. So that when we got on a boat going over there, that was nice. Yeah, we knew we were on our way.
Did you experience combat before you ever jumped out of an airplane? They took you over to Naples by ship, so you didn't jump into Italy, but they landed you on the beaches of Naples.
Naples was free. We went and stayed in a volcano. The vacant volcano was nice and green in the bottom of it. They kept us in there. And then we went north to Rome, got out in the olive orchard east of Rome, and hit the Germans out there. And then we just kept fighting, kept following them. And where we got in to the real battle was up at Grosseto. That's where Murphy got killed.
Yeah, let's hear about this, because your very first day of combat was, I mean, and I ask everybody, you know, what was that moment where you realized this is for real? Yeah. You had no choice, because you saw all kinds of things your first day of combat that most guys your age, 19, 20 years old, had never seen before.
Yeah, I was 19. Sergeant Bill Murphy was leading us, and run down and throw himself back of a stump because the Germans were shooting at him. I don't know what made him do it, but he just raised up, straight up, and looked over the top of the stump. And when he did, they shot him right between the eyes. And he fell, and with the back of his head all bloody and everything. And I run over there with the aide man, Anderton, all bloody and everything, with them white streaks in there. And I ask Anderton, "What's them white streaks?" And he says, "That's his brains." So that was my first deal on my first day. That's how you get taught.
Yeah, that's not exactly the welcome you're looking for. And the rest of that story is there. Your life was in danger, too. In fact, you guys had to take out some Germans there to survive, right?
Seven Germans, yeah. I was running back of Bill, and then all the guys were lined up like this around the top of that hill, and they were all firing. There was a lot of bullets going down in there, and we got them all seven of them.
Do you remember feeling scared at all?
Well, you can't. You're so scared, but you're so busy, you push it to the back of your mind, and it has to stay there.
Give us a sense of how prepared you were. What were you armed with? What were you carrying?
I had a .45 on my hip, a trench knife on my left leg, and an M1 rifle in my hand. That's what I run down through there firing that thing at them Germans. Then I had a .32 Beretta in a shoulder holster under my left arm.
Give us a sense, if you can, for how constant this combat was, because that was your first day, but I know it wasn't your last.
Yeah, that whole day we went up over the hill and down on where the Germans were, and that whole day we fought hard. I remember a kid from New York named Fisher was our machine gunner, and we're taught, and they're taught, to shoot across the stomach, you know, because you hit somebody in the stomach and you don't kill them, but they have to pick them up and take them back, and you tie up a whole bunch of rear echelon people by taking care of them. So old Fisher was sitting there, and two guys was holding him, and they had gauze all around his stomach. They tried to put him on the stretcher and straighten him out. No, and he wouldn't do it. So they had to carry him down to the ambulance in a sitting position and set him up in the ambulance, and he was still sitting, and he left, and about 2 or 3 months later, he came back.
So you see one of your buddies get shot through the head, and you have to see on your very first day of combat his brains scattered all over the place. Then another buddy gets basically sawed in half, and you see what happens to him. But you still don't allow yourself to think that it might be you next time.
That's a possibility every second. It takes a split second to get killed over there. And I was going down through them trees, and the leaves were just falling down off of them trees like a big storm, where all them bullets. See, they were down over there in the canyon by a house, and they were firing up that hill, and they were firing high over our heads, knocking all the leaves off of them trees. It was just like in a storm of trees leaves falling. That's how many bullets were coming up through there.
How close did they come to hitting you?
I don't know. They didn't. That's all I care about. Yeah.
Was it at all difficult for you to get used to or come to grips with the fact that some of the bullets you were firing were going to take the enemy's lives?
That's what you're trying to do. I mean, you strive with all your being to do that. And if you do it better than they do, you're going to come out. We got through that night. We had cleaned them out of that house down there and everything. And I go around, it's this big water tank. You know, I'd never seen any German spelling or anything. I go around the back of that tank and it says Drinkwasser. And I was surprised at that, how close their drinking water was to ours. It was Drinkwasser. There was a bunch of bushes over here, so it was getting dark. I go over there and lay down up in them bushes and sleep that night. Next morning I get up and start to walk around that way to go. And there was a dead German laying right the other side of the bush with me all night long. I didn't even know it.
That gets your attention.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that shakes you up.
What kind of weather conditions did you guys have to deal with there in Italy?
Mostly rain. Windy and rainy. And see, Grosseto was a hill country. We were a light infantry combat team, you know. We carried everything with us, and we could go everywhere. So that's what they sent us up there on them hills in there. We just kept going and going and going until we got about the third or fourth day. It sounds like a freight train going over us. And again, 30 minutes later, another freight train. What it was that long railroad gun that they had sitting down to sit at the Vecchia, and they were firing, trying to fire on us, but they were going over us and all the way over into the German position before it was coming down. That's how inaccurate they were with that thing. But it sounded just like you were standing on the ground, it sounded just like a freight train going through the air.
And I'm sure if you're listening at home, you're wondering just how big this gun was. Not quite as big as the infamous Gustav gun used against the Soviet forces on the Russian front, but pretty giant. There were two of them captured in Italy, Anzio Annie and the Anzio Express, and the Germans called them Leopold and Robert. The barrel, 71 feet long. If you go to Fort Lee in Virginia, you can actually see Anzio Annie for yourself. I have a photo on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. The shells were 11 inches in diameter and weighed 560 pounds apiece. Holy moly. And Mr. Fees, you heard it, then you actually got to see it.
By the time we got through there, we went to Città di Vecchia to kick off and go to southern France. They got in there with our airplanes and blowed everything to pieces. And that gun laid out across there just seemed like forever out through that lot. So I got to see that thing firsthand right up close after hearing it come over.
And I imagine after hearing it, you probably didn't need to see it to know how much damage it was capable of.
If you looked up there, you could just about see it going through the air. Those shells were that big. Man, they were big. And they fired, maybe several hundred rounds before the rain lifted and our planes got to them. See, that's what was our problem. The weather would stop them planes from coming in. Once we had a little clearing, why, them planes came in and got that thing because they knew where it was.
And you're describing things from your perspective, but I know you also have an understanding of the bigger picture and how fortunate you were to survive, because when you look at the guys that you went over there with, you were part of the minority that survived, right?
That's right. I came back with 11 others with the company. Of course, 30 or 40 of the others had been hurt and came to the States and got healed. And when we got to Camp Shanks, New York, they were there waiting on us.
But how many did you start out with?
I don't know. What is it? 131, I think. Was in the company. So me and 12 others came back with the company, then 30 or 40 more. But we were a full company because they just kept bringing in replacements all the time.
But from the original group, only a handful of you.
My buddies that I trained with, and we were just like brothers. We lived in the barracks, you know, and we loved each other. We'd die for each other if we had to. That's just the way it was. When we ended up, we were looking down across the valley to the Po River, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa was over there on the other side. You could see it cocked over this side like that. That's when they pulled us out, and the 99th Infantry Division relieved us, and we went and started getting ready to go invade southern France.
I know that you didn't leave Italy without some souvenirs, because I'm looking at one of them right over here. It's a beautiful 1940s-era phonograph. Where'd you get that?
I got that out of the USO in Rome, Italy, before we got in combat, and Bill Murphy and Edward Dis were with me with two other guys, and I was in the middle with my coat over that. And then another story, when I got home with it, had it in my bag, and an MP up at Camp Beale was going to take it away from me, and I told him, no, you're not, I'm going to whip you if you do. So he went and got the officer, and the officer had common sense and says, it's his, let him take it home. So I still got it.
Well, and that's a pretty big item to be carrying around all this time.
It's priceless to me because of Bill Murphy and Edward Dis. Edward Dis blew up a mortar 2 weeks later and killed himself. And then Bill Murphy got killed the first day of combat up there. So that phonograph is priceless to me. I wouldn't part with it for nothing.
I can see it reminds you of that, what could have been your fate and the price that's been paid, huh?
It's my tribute to them. They're my buddies, and they're not here, so, you know.
And you mentioned how Edward's life was claimed with an accident with his mortar. You spent some time on a 60-millimeter mortar, too. When did that begin?
I fired thousands of rounds of 60-millimeter mortar over there. But this was out on a practice range, so they brought this bunch of shells out there, and some of them had rust around them on the point. You know where that button is on the point? Mm-hmm. On a mortar round has got a button on the point. When it comes down and hits, that explodes. And he dropped it in there, and it just smoked and fiddled and just barely come up and dropped out on the ground. And darn it, he didn't grab it and stick it back in there. And when he did, it exploded and killed him right there.
Did you have to witness that?
Oh, yeah. We was off over there playing cards about 50, 60 feet away. And two of his men got hurt, got shrapnel in the back. But this was right close, and he just had holes all over him. Two of his crew got hurt, but Diss was the only one who got killed. Kid from New York City, Edward Diss.
One of the more than 405,000 Americans who did not make it home from the war. Walter Fees did make it home, but not without some more close calls. And we haven't even gotten to his first combat jump yet with the 517th Parachute Regimental Combat Team. That would come in Operation Dragoon in August of 1944. And we'll explore that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. One of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that their real sincerity and a genuine spirit are things that really make an impression on me. And that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years. I've heard them say it's all about serving their members, and then I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, EECU demonstrates over and over again what 200,000 members already know. EECU takes you personally. Go to myeecu.org to find out for yourself, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.